Welcome back to Inside Track. Bruce and Eb back at you, broadcasting in the Perfection Auto Works studios today. Eb and I want to remind you to support all of our great Inside Track sponsors. Eb Wilkinson at Wilkinson Wealth Management, Eric Rudin at Essential Pest, Jay Kipper and Craig at Tucson Auto Metal Retail, and Mike Emery from Perfection Auto Works. We support each of these locally owned, family-run businesses. So should you. School board elections used to be treated as minor elected posts without much scrutiny by parents or the general public until COVID, when moms and dads started paying attention, period, to lesson plans their kids were working on while banned from the classroom. Our next guest, Ryan Gerdersky, and his group, the 1776 Project, has set out to help students and family-friendly candidates to school boards across America become more successful. Greetings, Ryan, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to see it wasn't you that's getting married today, but you freaked out a little.
Yeah. We were kind of concerned.
This friend of mine is, I'm at her wedding right now in the garden, so it should be quiet enough. But yeah, a good childhood friend of mine is getting married today, so I was worried about the timing, but we made it work.
So here in Southern Arizona, parents have been fighting with local school boards and their policies for years with little success. What is your history, and why was the 1776 Project organized?
So I had a godson who was in, I believe, the fourth grade at the time of COVID, and they were doing lesson plans at homes like, you know, any other school district basically in America in 2020. And his parents became aware of some of the lesson plans he was learning in the books they were reading. There was a book called It Happened in Our Town and Race Cars, and they basically told and instructed children that police were racially segregating who they were stopping at in their cars. That's why it's called race cars. And the parents were very upset, and they went to the superintendent, they went to the principal, they went to the council member, and they called me to get involved because I had helped a lot of local elected officials get elected. And I realized it was a problem locally, and I said, I wonder if this is a problem nationwide. So I said, I can create a PAC, and I knew enough people in the media, and I had worked in politics for a long enough time to see if I could make something of it. And in our first year, we endorsed 58 candidates and 42 won. And then our second year, we endorsed over 100 candidates. And then this year now, we're campaigning on behalf of 200 candidates. So we're very lucky to grow each and every single year.
Why do you think it is that you have grown? Is it because of your success or your message or both?
I think that for a long time, conservatives, to their own detriment, have looked at education and only talked about school choice. They've kind of left curriculum to liberals for a very, very, very long time. There have been some fights over textbooks, but not many. And that is wrong. And a majority of children in America go to public school. Every child deserves a quality public education if they want to go to public school. In rural communities where a lot of Republicans live, there are no options aside from public school. And it is up to conservatives to fight for those children. You cannot leave it to just the school board and the teachers union to sit there and to decide what the kids learn. And it's very hard work. Campaigning for school boards is not particularly, the sexiest politics in the world. It's not president, it's not the U.S. Senate. But it's worth it, and I think that because no one else has taken advantage of the moment, I think I filled a void, and that's why the PAC has grown and has had as many successes as it's had.
Besides the Eb here, besides the 1619 Project influence, when did public education begin to veer off course, and how does the 1776 Project plan to right this problem, which is so crucial in a constitutional republic?
That's such a great question, because liberals love to blame me in some way for politicizing public education, when in fact there's always been a political element of public education from the get-go. You know, everything from the Pledge of Allegiance to school prayer to the NEA, the National Education Association, in 1949 banning open communists from becoming teachers, which is something that the NEA did in the late 40s, early 50s. All of those things were part of our public education conversation. I think that the narrative around what is our goal as a country changed some point between me going to elementary school in the 90s to my godson, as I said before, going to school in the 2020s and 2010s. At some point, colorblindness was no longer the goal. Colorblindness was what, growing up, everyone aspired to have. You know, I did not grow up in the I'm 36 years old. I didn't grow up when segregation was a thing. I didn't grow up when slavery was a thing. I didn't grow up when a lot of these things were not a thing anymore, busing. And the goal was that we would have a successful society based on merit. And around 2014, I really specifically say around the time of the Ferguson riots, wokeism is when they first took its real effect, where they doubled and tripled down to sit there and wash away the idea of merit, wash away the idea of accomplishment, and embed critical theory of many types, critical gender theory, critical race theory, within the system as a whole, to a point that by 2020, even though they've been working at this for 7 years, really in-depthly working at this for 7 years, people had not paid attention long enough. So by the time it was really taking effect, they were like, I can't believe this. I can't believe it's as bad as it's been. It was slowly creeping up, and then when Ferguson happened, I think it accelerated.
Let me read to you. This is from an address by a Florida congressman in the 1960s. He actually gave this address on January 10th, 1963. His name was A.S. Herlong Jr. from Florida. He talked about how the nation was going to be lost, and he cited these factors. I'll just quickly read them to you. Get control of the schools. Gain control of all student newspapers. Continue discrediting American confidence and culture, degrading all forms of artistic expression. Eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression in schools. Discredit the American Constitution, calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step with modern needs. Discredit the American founding fathers. Belittle all forms of American culture and discourage the teaching of American history on the ground that it was only a minor part of the big picture. These are the things that have actually happened. This guy is like Nostradamus. Right?
Yeah, no, he nailed it. And it's not that, it's that the, so a big part of it is the colleges, because how teachers come out of the colleges to learn how to teach is part of it. But a bigger part of it that no one really picks up on, a lot of people blame teachers. I genuinely don't, because I think a lot of teachers work very hard and try very hard, are fairly apolitical. It's the administrators that demand these things, administrators that hire these DEI professionals that make far more than a teacher does, whose only goal is to look at racism. The city of Pittsburgh just this week hired a DEI administrator to try to figure out how to phase racism out of math. Because the belief system is that if there is any inequality between the races, there is some systematic oppression going on.
In math?
Possibly be, yes, in anything. In anything.
How is there systematic racism in math? 2 and 2 still equals 4.
Because I know that you are coherent in your thinking process, but a lot of people aren't. So because a lot of Black and Hispanic kids are not doing as well in math as white and Asian kids, therefore, it's some sort of systematic oppression. This is really what they believe in every form of life. So not the problem could not be that 80-something percent of Black students come from broken homes. The problem could not be that there's not enough early childhood intervention. Their problem could not be that, you know,
blame it on the man. Blame it on the man. Don't take the blame yourself.
And yet in the 50s, Black couples, married couples, were more likely out there with kids than white married couples.
Well, the thing is that some good news that no one really talks about, and it's important to say good news when it's there, the state of Mississippi about 6 years ago passed a law that if you could not read at a third grade level, you cannot go to fourth grade. Because so often what we see in schools,
that's the grade,
is administrators put failing kids forward. Kids who can't, if you cannot read at a third grade level and you go to fourth and you go to fifth and you go to sixth, by the time you get to eighth grade, the teachers really can't do a ton for you. It's just you're so far behind.
Right.
So many kids fall through the cracks and they fail forwards. So Mississippi passed this law about several years ago. There was a couple hundred million dollars allocated, private funds, for early childhood intervention. And what happened was, is over 5 years, the law was enforced properly. The unions went along with it. I mean, they're not strong unions in Mississippi, but they're unions nonetheless. And the state went from number 49 in reading, third grade reading, to number 29 over a five-year period.
Wow.
Now, the schools didn't blow up with money. The teachers did not change dramatically. The student population, which is probably half black, half white, did not change dramatically. What changed was they said you cannot continue to fail kids forward. And so Mississippi will do far better than their colleagues in over every neighboring state and a lot of, by the way, other states that sit there and say, no, let's just make sure that our overall numbers look good. It doesn't matter if they can pass or they can fail, as they can read or they can do math. As long as they're graduating, our numbers look good, and that's all that matters. So those kinds of reforms are happening slowly. One of the school districts that we got involved in early last year, Miami-Dade, they passed a new resolution to try to bring classic literature back into the curriculum. They'll learn classics. This is a school district, by the way, of millions of people, hundreds of thousands of children, majority of whom are immigrants, majority of whom do not speak English at home, and they're learning, they're reading Chaucer, they're reading Shakespeare, they're reading the classic Western canon that has been demonized so heavily in other school districts. This is the type of effort that conservatives are waking up to and saying, we can do this, and the excuse of, oh, they're too poor, or they're immigrants, or they're minorities, or whatever, we cannot continue to sit there and bow to that rhetoric. We have to reform the systems for one, the sake of their own, for poor children, but also for the sake of our own kids who are being indoctrinated into a belief to hate everything that's great about America.
Well, alas, poor York, I knew him well, but we've got a caller right now who has a question about school textbooks. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Many years ago when I went to school, part of it, in the early years, I was homeschooled, later on to government schools. But we always received our textbooks from the state that I was in. The state was actually printed on the textbooks. Why is that not still going on, or possibly is it still going on in some states?
Thanks, Paul.
So the biggest purchaser of textbooks is the state of Texas. And most states purchase whatever textbooks Texas purchases because they basically buy in bulk and in mass. This is, I mean, it's a good thing Texas has a lot of review over their textbook systems, but this is a fight for the 20th century. Right now what's happening is individual school districts are buying more and more curriculum, surpassing textbooks and buying technology straight from Silicon Valley. So they're buying into programs that sit there and have a lot of woke ideology incorporated in it that has no proper review from textbook companies because kids learn on tablets now. That's really where the conversation needs to happen. A majority, I think it's 97% of all online classroom apps sell children's data to third-party vendors for advertisements currently. Very few school boards have picked up on this and demanded real transparency to where their kids' data is going and really demanded that these Silicon Valley companies change to their values rather than buying into Silicon Valley's.
Ryan, give me those stats again about the advertising.
96% of all apps that are used in schools, and this is from The Hill and several other accredited news sources, 96% of them sell kids' data to third-party advertisers. So a lot of school boards will get free apps. That's the idea. It's like, oh, it's a free app. Nothing is free. What they're doing is they're storing your children's data and then selling it to advertisers. Now, not all apps do that. There are a few that don't. But it should be contractual that if a school district is using an app, that the kid's data is protected and not resold outside of the school system. Obviously, keep the data for the teachers to know and for the administrators to know. And, you know, if little Johnny is suffering in English, that the next teacher next year knows, or whatever the case may be, or the parents know. But it should not then be used for advertisers to then resell and repackage his information for advertisers later on. But it is being used, Sally, in almost every case.
Ryan, we have a caller, Charles Heller, on the line. Charles, your question or comment?
You know, Em, I cannot believe that you don't know how racist saying 2 plus 2 equals 4 is.
Eb's a racist.
Where did that come from? Mr. Kudurski, where did the idea that the right answer to a question is therefore an expression of racism, where did that come from, and how do we fix it? And I'll listen to the answer on the air.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you so much for calling. So it all comes out of the Frankfurt School of Ideology, which is to look at any inequities in society and blame society for creating those inequities. So you could sit there, and there's an old phrase saying, don't hate the player, hate the game. Now it's hate the game, don't hate the player. So we have a system, we have an issue in our society right now where a lot of poor kids, primarily Black and Hispanic, are failing very large in math and English, math and reading. The problem, therefore, is not that we have an issue where we're not dealing with children in early intervention, we have too many broken homes, we have too many parents that treat public education like a babysitting program, which is a lot of parents do, unfortunately. And we have a teachers unions in many states that look out for the teachers and not for the children. Rather that, we're saying, well, the entire system must be broken then. If there's not perfect equality, then therefore the system must be broken. It's the same thing with policing. They're sitting there and saying, well, they only broke a window. It's not that bad of a problem. It's not like they murdered somebody. And let's overlook things so we have perfect equality. And even in school districts in really red states, in Florida, we were noticing the administrators were demanding that they had perfect equality in the amount of detentions by race they were giving to children. So children, if they were born of a certain race that committed something that would, you know, qualify an expulsion or suspension, were not giving expulsions or suspensions because they needed perfect equality among the races. This is all critical theory. This is all to sit there and say any inequality is therefore proof of a racist system. And they're willing to destroy anything. I mean, and it sounds crazy in first through K through eight schools. It's happening in medical schools. It's happening in engineering schools. The graduate programs are doing this as well. One of the most awarded and accredited college professors in teaching is at the University of Illinois school system, and she teaches the program called Decolonizing Math. How to decolonize math, how to make math less European. This is insanity, but it's happening at a very profound level, and it's up to us right now. Republican governments, in-state governments, start dismantling the university system the way it's been handling this. That's what Governor DeSantis has been doing, and a few other Governor Abbott started doing this as well, breaking apart the DEI system one brick by brick.
As they should.
But then for the K through eight schools to sit there and demand that the teachers unions demand to defund any programs or any administrators that are doing this. We're doing an election on Tuesday in Blue Valley, Kansas, very wealthy, very white county. They just banned in 2020. They banned teaching of Mice and Men and teaching of To Kill a Mockingbird because it's too racist.
Wow.
They're willing to sit there. Yes, they're willing to do anything to sit there if it dismantle any system, any system that's working out of the argument of tolerance and racial cohesion. And it's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. You know, we're very my big argument always is this. I'm 36 years old. I'm a millennial. I'm that generation that apparently knows nothing. But I think that a lot of people take the immense amount of wealth and safety and prosperity we enjoy in America for granted.
That's right.
We assume that it's always going to be this way. It always was this way, and it can never fall apart. When it took generations of men greater than myself to create something so amazing that I don't deserve to inherit. I didn't deserve to sit there and live in a place that is genuinely safe, that has heating and electricity and running water and is peaceful in a democratic election, all the rest that we have, that we benefited from. And I don't think there's enough men and women right now willing to sit there and say, no, this civilization that Western men created needs to be preserved at any cost. And too many of them are being railroaded out of the fear in general of being called a racist. And it's nonsense.
What does a successful campaign look like in 3 minutes or less? What does a successful campaign look like in order to change a school district? What does that kind of a campaign take?
First thing that a school, if you win a one, you got to win. You got to win the election. And then hire a third-party auditor to look at whatever DEI programs are being used within the school system, because there's so much. There's a swamp in Washington, but there's a swamp in every school system. Figure out what is your school district actually spending money on? What electronic programs, what internet apps, what DEI programs? Figure out where all the money is being spent, and then one by one, dismantling it and put in protocols that actually help kids exceed at reading and math, learn proper history, learn civics, and really restore faith in your public education, because it is important. Public education matters, and people deserve to know their public education's okay. They all pay tax dollars to them.
Wow. Thanks, Ryan. Tell our listeners how they can find out more about the 1776 Project. If they're thinking about running for school boards, or if they want to support the work of the 1776 Project PAC.
Yeah, Arizona school boards are next November, so if you want to run, you have to file now. Go to the 1776 Project PAC, PACPAC.com. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I'm at Ryan Gerduski on all those platforms, and 1776projectpac.com.
Ryan, thank you so much. We hope to chat with you again real soon. And to those friends of ours in the resistance, dos más dos es igual a cuatro. When we return, Bunker de France joins us for a live report from the Empire Ranch, which is celebrating the Cowboy Festival. Stay tuned. Lots more coming up when we return. No station flipping.
Leaves bugs belly up with science.
You mean you don't use a shoe?
No, we use the latest in technology and innovation to eliminate bugs, termites, weeds, and more.
No spray cans and lighters?
None of that. Only solutions that target insect biology, using chemistry to help protect the environment, people, and their pets.
Huh. Essential Pest Control leaves bugs belly up. Call 886-3029 or visit EssentialPest.com.
Many people are familiar with the Battle of Debeka Pass in Iraq, but few knew the inside story until now.
Sergeant, move forward with your Humvee and engage that target with your 50.
Roger.
Nuts! The Hummer's down! Switch to the emergency freak!
Perfection Base, Roughneck 9-1.
Perfection Autoworks, go Roughneck.
Perfection, Humvee cranks but it won't start.
Do you have wire and a knife?
Roger. Plenty of both, Perfection Base.
Strip the ends and run it from the battery to the coil.
Copy. Jump the coil. Sorry about that noise. That RPG was close.
From a Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, Volvo, or even a Penzgauer, we fix them all. Call today, 323-8650. And PerfectionAutoWorks.com.
Perfection Base. Target destroyed. Thanks, Mike.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. When people turn 50, something miraculous happens. They start to get serious about retirement planning. They've done very well so far and want to be certain they power into the retirement they've earned. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call me, Eb Wilkinson, at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.
Welcome back to Inside Track, brought to you in the Perfection Auto Works Studios by Essential Pest, Wilkinson Wealth Management,
woohoo,
and the aforementioned Perfection Auto Works. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We're waiting for Bunker de France to call in from the Empire Ranch. He may or may not do that, but never fear. We do have a guest, Ed Wright, who is a scholar on Middle East history and Judaic studies at the University of Arizona, and truly one of the brightest minds here in Arizona on the topic. You know, it was an incredible conversation that we just had with Ryan regarding education. How, I mean, when two and two doesn't equal four anymore, there is...
When math is racist,
it's like rotten from the head down.
It is. And not only when you're doing it in math, but you're doing it in medical school. I'm sorry, red blood is still red regardless.
Right.
You know,
and there's going to be a lot of our red blood flowing.
And there's
if you're not handling it right,
as there has been. I mean, now the good news is I think we've got 27 states that are now constitutional carry out of Barack Obama's remaining 57 states. So we've got another 30 to go, and we're working hard on that. Hey, I was reading about Michael Johnson in the news.
Yeah,
great article. The new speaker of the scored a giant win yesterday. As we know, it's impressive because Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer, and I'm quoting from this article, are having anxiety attacks. Not only did Speaker Johnson's strategy to divide Israel from Ukraine funding pass on the House floor, but he even corralled 12 Democrat votes.
He did.
Even better, these Democrats agreed that the GOP's sensible demand of paying for the bill by cutting $14 billion with a B dollars from the Biden's supersized IRS budget with more than 87,000 new hires. For him to do that, Bruce, is absolutely incredible.
He did it without a lot of fanfare either.
Yeah, it basically went unnoticed, except for the Democrats that didn't vote for it.
You mean the Hamas caucus in the
Hamas
US
caucuses.
House?
Absolutely. And, of course, the number two story is the Democratic donor, Sam Bankman-Fried, is now a convicted felon. He's
He could get 110 years.
Convicted on all felony accounts. This is just incredible. And he was one of the, let me see this here, was he the number two donor to the DSCC? You know, tens of millions of dollars. It's just incredible.
Actually, it was stolen funds from his investors is what it was.
It was, but he felt it was important to try and, you know,
leverage.
Affect outcome.
Yeah, it would work out well for them.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing that this just came out is the new hire programs. The government is leading the way with another 51,000 government workers, second only to healthcare, where 55,000 were hired. So you had 531,000 9-month net government, 464 new healthcare, 445 leisure and hospitality, mining and logging, 17,000.
Oh,
that's incredible.
So investors had a pretty good week this week.
Investors had a great week this week.
I think the largest single weekly increase in several months.
Absolutely. Thank God.
I felt a little better about myself on Friday.
Well, I've told you, Bruce, you know, this time it's not different, and this too shall pass. It's going to be great.
All right. Well, speaking about great, we have Middle East scholar Ed Wright joining us. Bunker must be preoccupied at the ranch, so we're going to proceed with Ed. Ed Wright, we're glad to have you on the show. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. It's always a pleasure to be with you, to be back here talking about important things.
So before we talk, we want to talk about the history of Hamas on violence. You and I have been in Israel a number of times. You have lived for long periods, years at a time, in Israel. What have your experiences been with this sort of violence, both rocket attacks, you know, personal attacks, you know, random murders and so on, during the time that you've spent in Israel?
Well, that's a great question, Bruce. And my time goes back to the early mid-90s.
Right.
So the world has changed entirely from those days. There are still, I mean, the problems that we have today were problems back then. but how people are responding and the degree of violence obviously has changed dramatically. I used to, I had a friend who worked for a relief agency in Gaza, and I would go from Jerusalem, I would help him transport furniture that these furniture makers in Gaza were wanting to sell in Jerusalem. And I would a few times go with him. He had a pickup, and we would pick these things up and take them to the place where they could be sold in Jerusalem. And you could come in and go out of Gaza quite easily. And it was, Bruce and I don't know, a couple of years ago, we were up in Ramallah. It was as pleasant as going to Ramallah and as easy. So all that has changed with the rise of Hamas when it came into power after the breakdown of the Hamas-Fatah relationship in 2006 after the elections. And then in 2007, when Hamas took over in the coup d'etat in Gaza. And from its outset, Hamas has been violent. It's part of its character. It's the core of its character, actually.
So in terms of, let's focus on that election for just a moment. So Fatah, this is Mahmoud Abbas, right?
Correct, yes.
They won an election. There was a coup d'etat. Hamas now essentially runs that area, the Gaza Strip, essentially. Israel vacated that area in 2007. And after that coup d'etat, there's been, what kind of government? Has it been a democratically run government? Has it been a dictatorship? Is it a kleptocracy? What kind of a government is Hamas, separate from the fighting?
Can I do, if this is multiple choice, can I do all of the above? Yeah, no, it's all of those things. There've been no elections. They appoint who the leader is. The founder of Hamas was a fellow by the name of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, who was a sheikh. He was confined to a wheelchair from an accident, I think when he was a teenager or something. And when he took over, he has a Wahhabi kind of background. He came out of the Muslim Brotherhood back in the day. It was the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine. They broke off from the Muslim Brotherhood and established their own entity in, what was it, 1987, 88, I think it was 87. And so he was in charge. He lasted in 2004 doing promoting terrorist actions against Israelis. The Israelis took him out by a bomb, a Hellfire missile, in 2004. He was replaced by his partner, who was the co-founder of Hamas, Abdel Aziz al-Rantizi, and he lasted about a month before the Israelis took him out. And then it goes on from one after another. And the leaders now live in Doha, in Qatar, in Beirut. And one person who is the what do you want to call it, the leader in Gaza himself is Yahya Sinwar. He's the only one who lives in Gaza of the leadership. And these are people whose goal is to expel Jews from the land, to eliminate Israel, and to establish an Islamic state in the lands of Palestine. It's not like ISIS, who wants to do a caliphate across all Muslim lands. They just want to have an Islamic state in Palestine. But to do that, they have a one-state goal. That is to remove Israel and replace it with an Islamic state. And they do so with militaristic force, with, as we now know, butchery to implement that long-term goal. And it's a long-term goal they won't give up.
So an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, they're the one, they were responsible for the coup d'etat. and it's this wing of government, if you will, if you want to call it that, who is now in charge and has been in charge. What kind of, I mean, several hundreds of millions, maybe probably closer to the billions of dollars in aid has gone to the government in Gaza. Where is that money gone? Based upon your living in the area and your knowledge of news on the ground.
Sure. I think every state knows that what has happened, and including the Israelis, knows that they have pilfered the money that has come in. Money comes in to support the hospitals, schools, whatever. And yet the hospitals, the schools, the social services are poor at best. And they siphon off the money to build tunnels, to acquire the technology and the expertise to build rockets and bombs, and to support the Hamas fighters. They're not there to support the people. However, I will tell you, and I'll say that, you know, that is a fact. I think everyone working in the area knows it. The other thing you'll hear, and I once you say something like that, somebody will say, well, they do a lot of social service stuff. In fact, they do. The social service wing, there are three wings to Hamas, the social service wing, the diplomatic wing, and the military wing. The social service wing gets money, but then the military wing siphons it off. So, yes, they do. Hamas will tell you they do good things in hospitals, and I'm going to tell you they have done good things. But it's not to the extent that the money they've been given would represent. That because so much is siphoned off over to the military wing to do these attacks against Israel. Because, again, in its charter, the goal is the destruction of Israel. And all their actions are, in the end, focused on that. I call it an apocalyptic group. This is like an apocalyptic cult. And you can't bomb apocalyptic ideas out of people. You have to offer other options.
Yeah, Ed Wilkinson here. Tell us about the difference between the Palestinians in Gaza and Hamas in Gaza.
Oh, that's a great question. We as Americans, it's hard for us to understand. They're living in a state that is run by thugs, a mafia of sorts, and you can't oppose them. Those people who supported Fatah in the 2006 when they were trying to resolve these disputes over the election, if you were a Fatah member or supporter, you were dead or they capped you, in the knees. There were, gosh, I forget how many hundreds of people that were killed or injured in part of that process because their goal is a religious goal. And if you are against them, then you're against God. The people who live there are in a difficult situation. There are some who are just devout supporters of Hamas, and there are some.
What's in it for them?
Anybody but Hamas.
What's in it for them being a supporter of Hamas?
Not getting capped.
Bingo. Oh. Yeah, think of it like the mafia. But there are people who they don't want to suffer like this. They don't want to have these rocket attacks going in, and all these lives. What are we at? 9,000 people plus. I think the UN estimated the other day was 9,000. It just exceeded 9,000, and tens of thousands, probably upwards to 30,000 injuries. They don't want that, but what are they going to do? And Hamas won't let them out. So you see how this is just an avalanche of energy against them. They have to sit there and take it until Hamas is taken out or they remove Hamas. But you're never going to get rid of that ideology of Hamas. It'll stay there, and that's why this will go on for some time. I think in the end, I hope and pray that good will come out and triumph in the end, and that those people will get their human rights and their humanitarian needs cared for. But it will take a while.
In what kind of a nation would there still be refugee camps inside a country 3/4 of a century after that area had largely been settled and run? What kind of a country is that where there are still refugee camps within the country? There's not a bunch of people moving to Gaza, is there?
No, you know, we couldn't get it. You can't get, it's hard to get in. It's hard as it is to get out, it's harder to get in.
So what kind of a person was living in the Jablaya refugee camp that was blown to smithereens the other day? Who would qualify to live in a place like that, and who would want to live there?
Those are people who, some of the families go back to 1948, and the others go back to 1967. They were refugees who came in. They sit there in those really squalid, you know, we wouldn't want to live in those places. And I had been in those. Even back in the day, they were bad. But what happens is those people were displaced from those wars, and they went there as refugees, seeking refuge. And the governing authorities of the Palestinians, no matter what form, hasn't taken care of them. Why not? Because they're props in their play. Just like they are human shields, their presence there and the deprivations they experience are a tool in the hands of Hamas. It's inhumane.
Eb here. I've not been to Israel yet. I'd like to go. Which means I've also not been to the Gaza Strip. Let's go back, for those of us who don't know their history as well, let's go back to prior to October 6th. Prior to October 7th, you know, October 6th and before. Let's say that you're a Palestinian living in the Gaza Strip and you wanted to leave and move and go into Israel. Is that possible? How much of a problem is it?
99% impossible.
So you can't even go visit?
No, no, no. Israel has the border closed. The Egyptians had the border closed. And there's no way out through the ocean because there's a blockade.
So you're not getting into Israel. You're not getting into Egypt.
Those are the only two options, yep.
Okay.
But what happens? Israel, and here is something, after this is all done, Netanyahu will face an inquiry about this.
Sure.
And the government will face this. And one of the things they'll have to talk about is allowing people coming and going from Gaza the way they have. Israel, you hear criticism of them not, allowing people to come in. They do allow workers to come in. And it has, in recent years, been a little more generous than what it used to be. They also do, in special cases for people with terrible health issues, injuries, and whatever, that need to be, that are first-order emergencies, there are arrangements to get some of those people to Israeli hospitals. So that happened. That's the Israelis doing that, humanitarian kind of work. Egypt, much less so. But so there are opportunities. That's the 1%. But for the most part, it is, it's not an opportunity. You unless you have an American, if you're a dual citizen or something, you're not going anywhere.
So let's talk about those people who have been granted entry into Israel, presumably under sort of worker permit programs. Is that correct?
Exactly.
So there have been those Palestinian workers. We've seen them working on construction projects over the years. I had understood that a lot of the new properties being constructed were by Chinese workers. Mm-hmm. But apparently during the Gantz and Lapid era running Israel, there was a considerable increase in those worker permits that were allowed. But even Netanyahu's government has granted even more permits since they came in. This is what you're talking about is going to cause a huge political problem for Likud, correct?
Sure. Well, it'll cause a problem. It's, you know, however you they have to negotiate these things, because you know, you need the workers and you want to give opportunities. This is part of the one thing I'm not hearing, because actually we're at a time of war right now, so probably it's not the time to hear it. But what's the plan for afterward?
Right.
But that's what will bring the end to Hamas, if you win the hearts and minds of the people by showing them a better way. And it's not as easy as just saying, okay, let Fatah run the place. Well, Fatah's corrupt to the core, too. So there needs to be a new kind of Palestinian leadership emerge. Again, in the West Bank, in the Palestinian Authority areas, the Palestinian National Authority areas. No elections. So this is not democracy as we understand it. And the people deserve better than what they're getting. There has to be a statement somewhere by someone, this is what we're going to do. It's going to take the Gulf states, the Saudis, the Qataris, right, the Emiratis. They're going to have to step up and really do something. But the money that comes in has to be watched much better than what we've done so far, under American governments and under Israeli governments. Money has gone in from these NGOs and other organizations, even from state money, has gone in and still been pilfered by Hamas because they're in control. Once that money gets in, it's fungible.
So if Netanyahu has his way, how does this end?
Well, Netanyahu right now is in war mode, as he has to be, I think. The question is, what comes after war? And I haven't heard that. I haven't heard that from him. You have to have a plan. Yeah, I was talking with my wife the other day. How do we get these people out of, and she's been in the same places. How do we get these people who are suffering so much, who are wanting to, you know, do this barbarism, how do we get that out of them? And I've been thinking about it, and I don't know that I've even shared it other than with my wife. How did we get the German people who were so supportive of the Nazi government to drop that? How did we get the Japanese who attacked Pearl Harbor, you know, all of these things from World War II? Just think of those two countries, who we were vicious enemies, and we viewed them in equally inhumane ways. I mean, think of the bigotries that were being thrown around during those wars between the different sides. How did we change that? Were they now great partners?
Because we rebuilt them.
Yeah, we did. You're worried. They're talking about the bombings in Gaza. I look at the statements of people's deaths. You can read them. And the International Order, the Red Cross, they'll put them up. And there are other different places. And read where these people, these terrorist people, are killed. It'll say died on, you know, October whatever and November 4th. Location, home. Next one, location, home. So these bombs that are going in there are targeted to the homes of terrorists or buildings in which terrorists are either living or working with doing their whatever their jobs are within the structure of Hamas. So those are not just throwing bombs at buildings. They're going after specific targets. And sadly, they're always, sadly, deeply sadly, civilian losses. And it's terrible, but, you know, and there are rules for this. How Israel conducts its wars follows the rules of the Geneva Conventions and the fourth convention and the additional protocol number one on how you target places, how you assess potential for damage, and what it will do to achieve your military goals. So it's terrible, but
Ed, we got to end it there. We're right up against the end of the hour. Thank you very much. I hope we can have you back on again soon as the as this whole thing unfolds. But thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks again to all our great guests today. David Moskowitz, GOP candidate for CD8 Blake Masters, Ryan Gudurski from the 1776 Project, and Ed Wright.
Almost bunker, but no bunker.
Almost bunker, but he's coming on soon along with Harry Alexander. And so tune in next week when we have a great Veterans Day show featuring veteran and U.S. Congressman Eli Crane and many other great guests scheduled. Please check out our Facebook, Twitter pages for the latest news and our views. We look forward to seeing you again in 166 days.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
A lot of the cities and the counties around have initiatives for artists. I think we're one of the premier artist suppliers for steel. First Saturday of every month, you can come down early and actually go through the scrap yard across the street. It's 7 acres of metal. You can walk through with our people and pick out what you want. It's always interesting to see what the artists have done. We've done actually a couple projects with the U of A Engineering Department and Music Department, where the engineering music students came down together. They had to pick something out of the scrap, and they had to build an instrument. And we have one of those in front of the plant. Some really cool things come out of the scrap.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Have you been taking your car to the Wicked Witch of the West for service?
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little fuel injection system, too!
Hi, this is Mike Emery at Perfection Auto Works, and despite rumors to the contrary, I am not
the great and powerful Wizard of Oz
of car repair. I do, however, enjoy performing miraculous recoveries on your family car or your exotic Jaguar, Mercedes, or Toyota. We specialize in Honda, Kia, Buick, Ford, Chevy, and even your grandmother's 1939 Packard. Call Perfection Auto Works at 323-8650. That's 323-8650 or perfectionautoworks.com.
There's no place like Perfection Auto Works. There's no place like Perfection Auto Works.
This is Eb Wilkinson of Wilkinson Wealth Management, where we manage money for gun owners. Some people view market declines as a time to panic. Good news, that's wrong. Markets have never gone down and then failed to come back to create new highs, and this time it's not different. Let me guide you to retire comfortably and remain comfortably retired. Call Eb Wilkinson at 777-1911. That's 777-1911.